Shrink Wrap Radio number 503, Exploring the Disease Model Debate with Professor Peter Kinderman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is University of Liverpool Professor of Clinical Psychology, Peter Kinderman, PhD, and we'll be discussing his open letter to the BBC about their biased coverage of mental health issues in recent programs. For more information about Dr. Peter Kinderman, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Transgenerational Trauma, Development of a Neurobiological Therapeutic Tool by Cassandra Garmston. You'll find it at theneuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that it will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Peter Kinderman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi. Yeah, good to be here.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show. Before we get into our main topic, maybe you can give us a little background on yourself.
Okay.
For example, when and how did you decide that you wanted to be a psychologist?
So I've been a clinical psychologist now for, I think, 25 years, because I'm very old. And I studied what's called natural sciences at university. And it's a degree where you start off studying all of the sciences, and for probably very good reasons. At the university I went to, they didn't offer psychology in the first year. But as I went through, I got more and more interested in psychology. And I guess, like lots of people, I realized that it spoke to issues that were important to me in my personal life. So I found it fascinating, and I found it interesting. I found it engaging. So when I left university, worked as an assistant psychologist in the National Health Service and just went up through the ranks and stayed there all the time.
Well, at what point did you decide that you wanted to move in the clinical direction?
I think it was after university, so just talking to tutors at university about possible options. And looking back, it was extremely relaxed. They suggested that if I wanted to go into clinical psychology, I should work in the National Health Service, work as an assistant, see what it's like, see if that was the career that I wanted to go in. I thought, I'll give that a bash, see where we go to. It didn't seem as pressurized 25 years ago in terms of paying off loans and careers and those things as it is now.
Yeah, so you have those issues over there too.
We made the tremendous mistake that I seriously hope North American cousins won't make, which is we elected a right-wing government. And then you know what? They did exactly what they promised.
Oh, yeah. That's what right-wing governments do. And we're always shocked that when it happens. Oh, no, they didn't really mean it. Yes, they did.
They said that the poor would have to pay for everything and the rich would get away with the offshore tax havens. And remarkably, that's precisely what they delivered for us. Yeah. So
yeah.
It's our fault. It's our fault.
I'm sure you're following our current election, and we won't go there. And the election's not even upon us yet, but we've been dealing with debates and so on ad nauseum.
It allows us to laugh at Americans, so that's always a good thing.
Okay, well, let's get into the reason I reached out to you. I was contacted by one of my listeners who said there was a raging controversy there in the UK, and it was centered around a series of BBC programs on mental health. So tell us about that kerfuffle, if you will.
Well, I mean, the BBC is one of the sort of much-loved institutions in the UK.
And here too, I might add.
Absolutely. I mean, they export a lot of good things. And a producer at the BBC led the way in proposing and then delivering a really very positive, to be honest, series of programs about mental health. And it didn't exactly commission lots of new programs, but it involved greater attention on mental health, greater focus on mental health, reflected discussions that were happening in other parts of the media, even in politics and so forth. And as part of it, they commissioned some new programs. And myself, my friends, both in the sort of critical psychiatry movement and the sort of more progressive parts of clinical psychology, were disturbed by not all of the programming and not all of the news reports, but some of the programs seem to have an extremely biomedical reductionist slant to them. And we paid attention to that, we drew attention to that rather, and we wrote a letter, an open letter, to the BBC Director General, raising our concerns about the very biomedical, as we saw it, quite reductionist slant of some of the programs that were part of this series.
You use the term critical psychiatry, and I don't think I've heard that term before.
So in the UK, there's been a tradition, I suppose, of psychiatrists from R.D. Lang, as Thomas Sasz, of course, but R.D. Lang, through a strong tradition of psychiatrists who focused on social perspectives, on, I guess, the medical tradition, the healing tradition of medicine, rather than the sort of biomedical science tradition of psychiatry. And so there is in the UK a network called Critical Psychiatry Network, and a number of the leading lights in British psychiatry are also leading lights of that network. And there's various ways in which those psychiatrists with a social psychiatry, more social deterministic strand, touch up against clinical psychologists who are sort of like-minded. So there's a set of nested Venn diagrams of more socially focused psychiatrists, less biomedical psychiatrists, with clinical psychologists who come from the same ilk. And like I say, there's a group called the Critical Psychiatry Network, which is quite an active group of psychiatrists.
Okay, that's interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Now, you've written about the what you feel is an excessive focus there on biomedical issues rather than what you've referred to as genuine biosocial approach. What would a genuine biosocial approach look like?
Well, I mean, it does get interesting and contentious. There was debate over the weekend, actually between a number of clinical psychologists talking about this, where that question of what genuine means, in our case, it was a question of what fundamental meant. So I think one of the tropes that we were talking about is something that was reflected in Eric Kandel's paper back in 1989, A New Intellectual Framework for...
The video froze for a moment there, but it looks like you're back. And yes. So repeat whatever you were saying. You were just talking about Eric Kandel.
Yeah, so he made the point there that every phenomenon that impacts on our lives involves biochemical changes in the brain. And he also argued that psychotherapy, if it were successful, I suppose if it were unsuccessful, has to achieve its effect through changing synapses. That was repeated by Thomas Insel recently, who made a quote saying something along the lines of all psychological phenomena are brain events. And there was actually an editorial in the British Journal of Psychiatry only a few days ago, again making the same point. And one of the phrases in that was to argue that psychotherapy, because it results in brain changes, should be considered a form of medication. Now, what's interesting about those, from those of us who are critical of that bio-reductionist perspective, is I think what we think is ungenuine about that, I suppose, is the idea that that means that the most fundamental and the most important way to understand these sorts of issues is in terms of changes at the level of the brain. And our perspective, I think, would be that not to deny the role of biochemistry, not to deny the role of genetics, but to ask what purposes do they serve? So if, for instance, you're talking about genetic differences between people that seem to be related to mental health issues, the question then would be, what impacts do those genetic factors have on psychological issues? How do they change the way that people make sense of the world? So if, for instance, you're looking at the research that Tim Crowe, former professor of psychiatry at Oxford, worked on, which is about the way in which we process information about language and genetic factors impacting on our use of language, there's obvious a relationship between those sorts of issues and auditory hallucinations. And the way in which we go about separating out things that we hear from things that we think clearly involve language processing in the brain. But for us, the genuineness is not to say, therefore, auditory hallucinations are symptoms of a biological illness, but to ask the more genuine question, which is, how does our biology serve those psychological processes by which we relate to other people, manage our emotions, make sense of the world? So for us, I think the genuineness comes that the brain as an organ is the organ with which we think, but it's thinking and feeling and emoting and relating and behaving that's the fundamental part of what makes us human. The biology serves that fundamental purpose, but the biology isn't the be-all and end-all of what it is to be human.
Yeah, so at least part of what you're saying is there's a strong correlation between what's going on in the brain and what's going on in life, but it's not necessarily a causal relationship.
That's true, but also, and it's also not necessarily unidirectional. So for instance, if you are exposed to a great deal of environmental stress, it will change your biochemistry. In fact, if you just close your eyes, it will change your biochemistry. When you put people into fMRI machines and you watch their neural activity in terms of the electrical activity in the brain, when we close our eyes and when we open our eyes, it changes blood flow, it changes the biochemistry of the brain, it changes the electrical activity of the brain. But that's the brain responding to the environment. So part of it is a correlation, which is what we see at the level of the brain correlates with what we see at the level of our emotions and our behavior and our thoughts. But it's also the case that sometimes the things that happen at the level of the brain and biochemistry are indeed causal. But what's interesting, I think, at least for me and I think for my colleagues, is that even when biochemical genetic factors can be causal, there's also a question of what that means for us as human beings. So, for instance, if I were born with a tendency to respond, biological tendency to respond very fearfully to threatening situations, then for me, what's fundamental is that's who I am, that's how I work. And I can learn to live with that, I can learn to respond to that. I'm not going to go around the world saying, what's fundamental about me is the way in which my biochemistry removes serotonin from the space between my my neurons. What's fundamental is whether I get fearful in social situations. So part of the genuineness is even when the biochemical factors, when the genetic factors are causal, they serve a purpose. And what's central to us as human beings is how we make sense of the world. So you're absolutely right. Part of the argument is some of the issues which the biochemical theories talk about may be just correlations of other events in people's lives. But even when they're causal, I think what's fundamental to us as human beings is how we think, how we relate, how we make sense of the world. An analogy I've used in other places is, you know, modern mechanized warfare is not fundamentally about the twitching of white men's trigger fingers. It's fundamentally about power politics. The twitching of trigger fingers is the mechanism by which we wage war, but that's not what fundamentally war is. And similarly, serotonin, dopamine, GABA, neurotransmitter activity isn't fundamentally what it is to be human.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned some research, and another researcher that you mentioned in something of yours that I read was a Emma Williamson and something called the Waterloo Project, and that was fascinating. Maybe you could take us through that.
I think that's another example of what I mean about the sort of genuine and fundamental nature of a psychosocial response. So Emma is a clinical psychologist who works in London, in a very deprived area of London, in a hostel for homeless people. And when you end up sleeping rough on the streets, typically you have a wide range of different problems in your lives, including often very serious mental health issues. So people are often, they use street drugs, they use alcohol a lot, they've often been in trouble with the police, their relationships have often broken down, and they've often developed really quite dysfunctional ways of relating to other people. Plus, they're often in debt, they're often physically unwell, there's a whole range of problems. So Emma works as a clinical psychologist within that hostel for homeless people, pulling together the different strands of social and physical and emotional need that they have, helping with a multidisciplinary formulation to see about how services can be directed to help people in very great distress. And I think that, as a model for working, is a very powerful way of saying how we, in multidisciplinary teams, can pull our expertise together to make sense of the social, the environmental, the personal, and also the biological factors that impinge on people's lives, to come up with a plan for what might be a route towards recovery for them.
Yeah, you've written, quotes, "To promote genuine psychological health and well-being, we need to protect and promote universal human rights." Now, this would suggest that mental health is maybe a political issue at root.
I think it is. I mean, one of the pieces of research that I've been involved in, I've been part of because the research has been produced in research groups that I've been part of, was work by Filippo Ferresi and Richard Bentel and others, looking at a meta-analysis of the relationship between trauma in childhood and the development of psychosis in later life. And one of the striking quotes that comes out of that, that my colleague Richard Bentel uses, is that the statistical relationship between multiple traumatic events in childhood and the later development of psychotic experiences is statistically greater than the relationship between cigarette smoking and squamous cell carcinoma. Now, of course, there's a biological route between the carcinogens in cigarette smoke and carcinoma and lung cancer as fundamentally a public health issue, at least in large part. And yet, when we look at psychosis and we look at mental health, the bioreductionist model, at least to many of us who are critical of it, would suggest that we really need to see this as an illness that needs to be treated. So the point of the focusing on human rights is to suggest that when people are made unemployed, when people are in debt, when people are made homeless, when people are abused, when people are exposed to refugee status, they lose their homes, when people are traumatized, when people are assaulted, and when people are impoverished, then it impacts on their mental health. And that's not to deny the role of biology in mental health problems, but it's to make sure that we at least pay due attention to the social and, yeah, as you say, the political aspects to this. Mental health is in part a crisis of poverty and abuse. And so for me, it's equally valid to analyze that from a social, from a political, as well as from a psychological and then a medical perspective. Absolutely.
It occurred to me a kind of devil's argument might be the poor have always been with you, right? And so poverty, war, and all those sorts of disasters have always been with us. Governments have always, maybe not always, but for a long time now, given lip service to the betterment of social conditions. That's what government is supposedly for. And yet, so much of that just doesn't change. So it makes me wonder if that's sort of a very nice ideal, that we need to change things for people at the bottom of society. But in the meantime, what do we do?
Well,
what does the clinician in his office or her office do with the folks today?
Well, I'm not sure that I have total sympathy for that, because if we extend that argument too far, what we say is the poor have always been with us, I would add, and the poor are being continuously harmed by their poverty.
Yeah.
But we won't pay any attention to that, we'll pay attention to this. What I'm saying is we need to pay attention to both. I mean, if the wealthiest person in the United States of America was currently experiencing emotional distress, I think we have a moral duty to offer him or her therapy. And we need to find out why they're distressed, and we need to offer them help with their problems. I don't think we should deny help to wealthy people, but equally, we know that mental health problems disproportionately affect poor people, minority ethnic groups, people who've been abused, people in difficult social circumstances. We also happen to know that more unequal countries, like the United Kingdom, I have to say, have higher rates of more serious mental health problems than more equal countries. So for me, I think it gives an onus, I suppose, on people working in mental health to look at social and preventative factors as well as treatment factors. So clearly we need to offer people therapy. We also need to offer people practical solutions to their problems. So, you know, when people are struggling with the emotional and relationship consequences of debt, we also need to offer them practical help with indebtedness. We need to see whether there are practical and financial solutions that can be part of the picture, as well as therapeutic solutions. I think if people are being emotionally damaged by the relationships that they're in, for instance, if they've got abusive partners, then what we need to do is work with them to change or escape from those relationships, as well as offering them therapy to cope with the emotional damage that's being caused. So I guess my answer is the poor have always been with us, but I don't therefore conclude that we should do nothing about that.
Right.
I think that the analysis that I'm putting forward suggests that that there is scientific evidence coming from the psychological and psychiatric fields to add weight to the idea that social, economic, and even political activity is just as valid as medical, psychotherapeutic, and social work intervention for people. So, yeah, no, I plead guilty to being a social and political activist, but I think the evidence points towards the conclusion that that's exactly what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. And you argue that we need to abandon the disease model of mental health care, and you even write that, you say, even mainstream medical authorities have begun to question the creeping medicalization of normal life and criticize the poor reliability, validity, utility, and humanity of conventional psychiatric diagnosis.
Yes. So we see that in a number of places. And I think it's important to stress, I mean, some of my colleagues in the UK have been quite critical of the idea that I have myself criticized the medical model. And I try to take care to criticize a disease model rather than a medical model, because I think that my colleagues who are medical practitioners absolutely have a role to play. I don't think that the metaphor of disease is a useful metaphor. So you can't say that it's just out of shot, but I have framed on the wall of my office the front cover of the British Medical Journal from the date of the publication of DSM-5 back in May 2013, I think. And it's got I'm looking at it now, it's got the face of a man covered in post-it notes. And in big red letters, it says, "Too many labels, the controversy over DSM-5. Now, admittedly, there's a question mark at the end of that. But I think that it's clear that the BMJ and other medical journals raise questions over the validity, utility, and reliability of standard diagnostic practices. And of course, ICD-10 and DSM-5 are really not very much different. That's in the BMJ. The Lancet, at the same time, published an editorial specifically focusing on the issue of the diagnosis of major depressive disorder when people are grieving over the death of loved ones, and asking the question that while we recognize that it's wise and valid and humane to identify distress in somebody who's recently lost a loved one, is it appropriate to diagnose them with a mental disorder? Does it make sense to suggest that they or their problems or their reaction is in some way disordered, that they haven't recovered from their grief in the normatively accepted time frame? And so there's the criticism within psychiatry of too many labels, are we labeling people inappropriately? And in that case, is an example of grief, is yes, I do think that the mainstream medical colleagues are questioning, not that we should not help people, but they're questioning whether the idea of disorder is appropriate. So veterans return from war and they've been traumatized by what they've experienced. And one way of putting it is they are experiencing post-traumatic stress. Is that disordered? I'm not sure that it's a useful metaphor. I think they're upset.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think it's causing damage to them. I think that the consequences damage other people. And that's the consequence of warfare. Is it disordered to be traumatized by warfare? I think it's traumatic to be traumatized by warfare, but I'm not sure that disorder, distress, yes, disorder, no. So the idea of the disease metaphor, I think, is crumbling. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I mean, you know, some kids find it difficult to pay attention. They're almost...
That's always been true.
That's always been true. And in DSM-5, I mean, as Phil Hickey pointed out, the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit disorder sound like a description of a normal childhood in many ways. There's caffeine dependence disorder, social anxiety disorder. I mean, what benefit do we conceivably get from adding the word disorder to social anxiety? I mean, I experience social anxiety from time to time.
Yeah.
Do I experience social anxiety disorder? What does it mean when we add the right. word disorder? So I think that those sorts of questions are being asked by radical, critical psychiatrists, mm-hmm. by a lot of psychologists, especially in Europe. But yes, I would maintain they're also being asked in the BMJ, in their editorial about DSM-5. They're also being asked by people like Tom Insel. Before Tom stepped down as the director of the National Institute for Mental Health, there was the program to develop RDoC, the Research Diagnostic Criteria, as an alternative to the standard diagnostic approaches. Why? Well, because the standard diagnostic categories don't map onto emergent biological findings. And that's a valid criticism. Whatever's going on for us as biological human beings, the genetics, the biochemical pathways, and the observable consequences on our mental health don't map onto those diagnostic disease categories. They don't make sense from a biological point of view. They don't make sense from a sociological point of view when we apply criteria to how long we expect people to grieve before we label it as disordered. They don't make sense from an ethical point of view. If I see a veteran who's been traumatized by warfare, it makes me feel slightly uneasy to suggest that there's something disordered in him or his reaction. I think it's a problem, but I don't think it's a disorder. And then if we move on to other issues, PTSD is a very good example. So currently in the UK, there's a soap opera running on radio about domestic violence. To what extent would a woman or a man who's been traumatized by domestic violence, to what extent is it appropriate to suggest that there's a disorder because they're showing the understandable consequences of being exposed to domestic violence? So yeah, absolutely. I think not only people like me are questioning the validity of applying a disease metaphor to those experiences, but I would maintain that people like the editorials in the BMJ, editorials in the Lancet, Tom Insel himself criticizing RDoC, yeah, all of them are saying that the current system just doesn't work. doesn't work.
Yeah, this certainly harkens back to Thomas Szasz, who you mentioned at the top of our interview. And it's I remember being very impressed by what he had to say when I was a graduate student. And so, and at times I've wondered, what happened to that, you know? Did that go away? And so it's good to hear that it hasn't gone away and that more people are revisiting it.
I think people are revisiting it. And I mean, I do need to make clear that this isn't a manifesto for saying that it's nothing to do with psychiatrists. I think it's something about whether these things represent disorders in the human spirit. And I think that that's why, for me, there's a conceptual link between this way of thinking, which is to regard us all as normal but flawed human beings struggling to make sense of and respond to the only world that we've got, but undeniably a flawed world. And that means that, for me, that the idea of seeing us not as disordered, or even our responses being evidence of disorders, but as just human beings responding in our flawed and even biologically variable ways to the stresses and strains of modern life, that does, for me, fit with the idea that there's a social, political, community basis to what we're doing, rather than just a medical approach. The reason why I think that that the ideas of Thomas Szasz haven't taken hold as much as they otherwise would is I think that there are lots of spurious but beguiling benefits for people other than the individuals experiencing distress from the industrialization of mental health services. So it suits politicians to say that the person is disordered and to put the problems out of mind. It suits the community in some ways to not reform the social structures that give rise to such distress, but to pick up the casualties later. It's useful, I think, to regard veterans who return home from war as having PTSD rather than to say, what are we going to do about this scourge on our modern times? And I think also, to be blunt, I think it suits the pharmaceutical industries to market products to deal with distress rather than to demand that we as a community of human beings respond to each other's distress.
Yeah, what you're saying triggers so many ideas in my mind. I have to try to remember them all. You know, we talk about mental health patients who there's the older concept of secondary gains that makes it hard for a person to recover from their issues because there are rewards inherent in it. And so what you've just described is that the government and other huge societal entities have secondary gains that make it in their interest to maybe not change things so much.
And I need to return to something that you were saying a little bit earlier, which, you know, I don't want to be critical, but I'll pick up on it a little bit, which is when you said, you know, the poor have always been with us. And if you can imagine...
I was playing devil's advocate, by the way.
If you imagine both a family doctor or maybe a politician or maybe a city councillor or a nurse or a medic working in an accident emergency department and somebody comes in acute distress, I think that the solution that I'm offering is an extremely challenging one. Whereas the solution of saying, I think you meet the criteria for a mental health problem, you may therefore want to take a referral to see a psychiatrist who can prescribe medication or therapy that can help you with that problem. You've got a pathway and a solution. You've got the recognition of the problems. The individual is receiving recognition and understanding and a solution, potential solution to their problems. The physician or the politician or the priest or whoever has got a route forward. So in a sense, it offers us all a beguiling quasi-solution to the person's problems. Yeah. What do you do with somebody, even if you're a police officer, what do you do with a woman who has been subject to domestic violence for 20 years? And what you can do is you can do your job as a policeman, and then what do you do? Well, then what you do is you say, and I think you probably should see a doctor, and you know maybe they can help with the emotional distress that you're experiencing. And it's a very attractive solution. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do that. I'm suggesting that we need to change the way that we think about it, as if those responses are actually treating an underlying illness. And I think there are best attempts to help people with a very difficult social and emotional situation, which may involve their personal biological vulnerabilities. But I think we need to think about it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, not only think about differently, but also speak and language these issues differently, since the two are so closely bound.
Well, one of the things that occurs, because like everybody, I find myself in communities of people who tend to agree with me. That's just what we do.
Yeah.
I prefer not to, but that's what happens. One of the comments that people have made is about the very well-known stress vulnerability model. And the stress vulnerability model, especially when it comes to serious mental health problems, is seen as a very inclusive way of talking about these issues. So the person has their own vulnerabilities. Some people are more vulnerable than others. Some people have greater or lesser resilience. Some of us also experience greater or lesser degrees of stress in our lives. And the idea would be that if you are particularly vulnerable, it doesn't take as much stress to trigger the onset of mental health problems in those people. And quite a few people who've experienced mental health problems are rather annoyed at the idea that instead of saying, let's examine the factors that have impacted negatively on your mental health, the message is that they should be regarded as somebody who's vulnerable. Hmm. And I think that's an interesting perspective. And
what it is, because it's not one that I've heard.
No, and what triggered in my mind is in law, there's certainly in the UK, there's a concept that, lawyers learn, which is the eggshell skull rule. And it refers in UK law to an actual incident where, in a rather nasty incident, one man punched another in the head. And the victim fell over and, I believe, died because he fractured his skull when he hit the floor. And the charge was of murder. And the defense was that he shouldn't be charged with murder because all he did was commit a felony assault, a battery. And that while the man died, the death was not, could not be attributed to the assault. It should be attributed to the fact that he had a biological issue that led him to have a particularly thin skull. And the outcome of this, which is reasonably well established in UK law, and actually, as the judge said, had been there for many years, is that you don't get a lesser sentence if you assault a child or a little old lady or a gentleman with walking sticks struggling to cross the road. Actually, you get a worse sentence. So when it comes to the law, what you don't say is individuals who have vulnerabilities differ in the degree of vulnerability. And we should regard the causal agent, the assault, as being of greater or lesser importance, bearing in mind the vulnerability of the victim. What we do is we prosecute people actually more seriously if they assault a vulnerable victim. So when it comes to the stress vulnerability model in schizophrenia, one of the arguments should be, of course we come with all sorts of vulnerabilities. But if we didn't see those as biological contributors to an illness, but rather part of the makeup of human nature that is true in the community of us as equals. You know, some of us have intellectual disabilities, some of us have physical disabilities, some of us have speech and language problems, some of us have eyesight problems, some of us are particularly tall, some of us are physically well built, some of us have biological makeups that make us more or less vulnerable to being assaulted when drinking in a Newcastle bar on a Friday night. And some of us are more emotionally sensitive than others. That's how people are built. So part of the argument is that maybe we should talk about and think about these things as being the inherent nature of the vulnerability, of the variability in human beings, rather than the biological contributors to illnesses.
You know, this puts me in mind of something that I discovered some time back. is that there is maybe an emerging field of clinical philosophy. And I have not interviewed a clinical philosopher yet, but it would seem to dovetail with this idea that it's got to do with problems in living.
I think there are lots of things that follow that are interesting. I went to a seminar at the University of Oxford, which is an impressive place to have a seminar. And one of the psychiatrists who was very interested in genetics pointed out that he, I think over dinner, had met a guy who had commented that he, the third party, was the son of a father who appeared to be extremely biologically vulnerable to the effects of alcohol. And this gentleman's assumption was that he may well have inherited that biological vulnerability.
Yes.
Which is why he decided never to touch alcohol. So the point there is that he was making a behavioral and cognitive choice to circumvent his biological destiny.
And I'm not quite sure what your point is there.
That's what we do all of the time. Now, what that means is several things to me, which is it means that the genetic factors that are associated with, for instance, vulnerability to problems with alcohol are entirely plausible. And I think the role of neuroscience, the role of biological science is extremely powerful. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you therefore conclude that the only thing that you need to do about alcohol is understand the biological pathways. What you can also do is decide to take a path in life which is different to the one that your genes embody for you.
Oh, okay.
So my point is that it's a philosophical, psychological, moral choice as well as a biological one. But it doesn't stop it being biological. So the role of medics is still there and still great. If it's the case that some people have biological traits that make them much less able to sit still for long periods of time in classrooms, I think that's very interesting. I'm not sure that I would conclude that means that they've got the biological traits of the disorder of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I think that it's wonderful that some of our kids are born that way, and maybe problems too, but that's the way that they're born. I think it's fantastic that some of us are much better at cycling than I am. I envy them their ability to cycle. That's the way that we're built. So I think that thinking about these things as human traits that bring benefits and advantages, but also bring downsides and problems, and that what we need to do is piece together the story of why a particular person is experiencing difficulties at this particular time in their lives, I think that's absolutely a biopsychosocial phenomenon, but it's not the same as diagnosing them with an illness and then treating it. And so my point is that it involves biology just as much as it involves psychology, but it still isn't necessarily the treatment of illnesses. So I was just riffing, I think, off your point about clinical philosophers, which is, you know, what does it mean to see the world or to see human nature in this way? And I think it's interesting.
Yeah. And it's interesting also to realize with your example of hyperactivity that some of those people go on to do fantastic things in the world. The people who couldn't pay attention in class and so on become CEOs and so on. There are plenty of examples of that.
Yeah, and there are all sorts of examples. I think that stretching the issue of the creative benefits of serious mental health problems sometimes pushes things a little bit. But I think that there are huge questions to be answered here. And one of them is whether the things that we're talking about are diseases in the sense of smallpox being a blight on the species, or whether the ability to see the world through different eyes is something that we should, as a species, be extremely grateful for. And there's a number of examples of this. One of them is that for many of the people that I see as clients for psychotherapy, they seem to be people who are genuinely very sensitive. And I note that oftentimes people are talking about issues where it's difficult for them to move on in their lives emotionally because of the distress that they experience at things that have happened. And that even extends to watching the television news. So people will say, you know, I'm feeling really, really upset today. I was watching the migrant crisis on TV and it just fills me with horror.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and to be perfectly honest, I'm sitting listening to them and I'm thinking, I watched it too. And then I got up halfway through it. I went and made myself a cup of tea. I fed the cat. I came back, checked my emails, and then carried on watching the news story. So who's the person with the disorder? The person who is emotionally touched by the distress in other people and has a negative consequence of that the next day? Or the psychopathic bastard who's sitting listening, who goes off and makes a cup of tea while watching footage of people drowning? I'm not absolutely convinced they've got the disorder and I haven't. I think another example, which I think is interesting, is my brother has very serious mental health problems, and I look at, you know, this is part of why I became a clinical psychologist, I think. And if you gave me the sequence A, B, C, complete the sequence, I will say Z, because D doesn't complete the sequence. D is the next in the sequence, but to complete the sequence, you go all the way to Z. And that's, I like to think, maybe I'm overextending the metaphor, but I like to think that's the way that my brain works. My students find me an engaging lecturer, but also very tangential. When I give interviews like this, people will say, he was all over the place. He was talking about clinical philosophy. He was talking about human rights. He was talking about watching the migrant crisis on TV. He was talking about philosophy and alcohol. I didn't know where Peter was coming from. That interview seemed to go all over the place. Well, maybe that's what I've inherited. Maybe I've inherited a brain that tends to go all over the place. Maybe I've inherited, biologically, neurons that tend to support a way of thinking where my thoughts go all over the place. And you know what? I think that's possibly true. I wouldn't be surprised if it were not true. And I think that loosening of associations, to go back to a phrase that Bleuler used, may well have negative consequences. I'm not always the most emotionally consistent of people in my lives, but lives, I think, more than one life in my life. But I think my vice chancellor values that trait in me very highly, because I'm intellectually creative, I'm intellectually spontaneous, I don't think in straight lines. Winston Churchill, incidentally, used to say that he, during the Second World War, said that he valued employing people who could think round corners. And there are massive personal benefits to having a lively, engaging, creative, non-parallel brain. I think that's a fantastic thing to have. But maybe whatever it is that I've inherited from my parents that gives me that sort of brain brings with it the risk that my brain will lead to emotional conclusions, that will have me going off on tangents, and that with certain other risks and circumstances in my life, it could cause me enormous emotional damage as well. So maybe it's good to be creative. It's good to inherit creativity, but not too much.
I think that could be a great wrap-up to this interview. I wonder if there's anything, though, that you'd like to add as we wind down here. We could go on. I've got a couple other ideas, but I've held you for some time here.
Because people who engage with me in debates on blogs and so forth are frustrated by some of the things that I say, I think that I want to say two things about the role of the brain as a physical organ and the role of doctors, medics, psychiatrists. And I suppose my point would be, I'm not stupidly naive to think that the organ with which I think is not the brain. I am aware that all of what I talk about in terms of our emotional and intellectual response to the events in our lives involves the functioning of the brain. And I think that it is obvious that genetic, biological, and other physical factors impact on my brain. Of course they do. So my brain is influenced by all of these things. My brain is the product of my genes, and my brain is the product of the biological substrate of my brain. But that's true when I'm writing poetry, which I don't do. It's true if I were to street drugs, it would affect the functioning of my brain. But my point is that biological route affects our mental health when it affects the way in which our brain makes sense of the world. So I don't deny at all biological elements in our mental health, but my point is that it's fundamentally a social and psychological phenomenon that we're looking at, where the brain plays its part in that process. But the brain is literally an organ. It serves a function for us rather than being the sort of be-all and end-all and final determinant of our behavior. So, you know, if you put me on a diet that reduces the amount of tryptophan in my body, tryptophan is a precursor of serotonin, it will have an effect on my mood. Of course it will. And as the tryptophan in my system is exhausted and my body finds it difficult to manufacture serotonin, that will have an effect on my brain, it will have an effect on my nervous system, and it will have an effect on my mood, because it would start to change the way that I think about the world. But it's how I think about the world is what's important. And if I take antidepressants, again, it will change my mood, it will change my thinking, it will change the way that I look at the world. But it's how we make sense of the world that's important. So for me, I'm not denying a biological element for this. And I'm absolutely not denying the role of colleagues from a psychiatric profession in helping people with mental health problems. I suppose what I'm saying is that the metaphor of talking about disease is only one of a number of metaphors that we could use to describe the relationship between events in the world, our body, and the consequences in terms of how we think and how we feel and how we act. And to sort of misquote Eric Kandel, given that every psychological process, even the most complex, involves synaptic changes at the level of the brain, then by that logic, we should diagnose voting for right-wing politicians, which is one of the things that we discussed right at the beginning of this, being a brain disease. We don't. It's a complex human response that, like every other response we make, involves the brain. So it's just the metaphor of regarding these things as illnesses and diseases that I think is the point that I want to draw out. What we're doing is making sense of the world. There's a variety of influences on how we make sense of the world. And then when we help people, what we do is try to understand what those influences have been, what the conclusions are, and then how the person maps their path out of the difficulties that they find themselves in. And I think the disease metaphor is only one of a number of possible metaphors, and I think it has lots of flaws to it.
Okay, well, if nothing else, you've underscored how complex the factors are that result in the problems of living that we deal with, and that there's not a simplistic approach isn't going to work. So I really want to thank you for sharing yourself and your ideas here and helping to re-enliven this debate that's been with us for some time. So Dr. Peter Kinderman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And I apologize for the convoluted nature of my thought processes. All I can do is blame my brain for it.
Dr. Kinderman is a blogger for Scientific American. We didn't get around to discussing what I thought was a very interesting point in one of his recent postings there. He raises the oft-quoted idea that the disease model takes the burden off the therapy client by suggesting it's not their fault any more than a broken leg is. Here's how he puts it in a subsection he's titled Stigma and Empathy. He writes, quote, "Traditionally, the idea that mental health problems are illnesses like any other and that therefore people should not be blamed or held responsible for their difficulties has been seen as a powerful tool to reduce stigma and discrimination." He goes on to say,
Unfortunately, the emphasis on biological explanations for mental health problems may not help matters because it presents problems as a fundamental, heritable, and immutable part of the individual. In contrast, a more genuinely empathic approach would be to understand how we all respond emotionally to life's challenges. Close quote. I had planned to put another somewhat challenging question to him, but we ran out of time. I wanted to get his take on recent developments in neurofeedback, in which the practitioner targets specific areas of the brain, depending upon the diagnosis, to either upregulate or downregulate activity in that area as is appropriate for the condition. I remember one of my guests in particular reporting very good results. Specifically, I'm recalling episode number 452, Neurofeedback in the Treatment of Developmental Trauma with Siburn Fisher, MA. I would have been interested to hear his comments on this. I certainly do agree with Dr. Kinderman that the social and political environment play a very large role in shaping our brains, and that the negative experiences in that realm are major contributors to what we've called psychopathology. Dr. Kinderman has a new book on this topic. The book is titled A Prescription for Psychiatry. In it, he offers a manifesto for mental health and well-being. And not surprisingly, he argues mental health services should be based on the premise that the origins of distress are largely social. Once again, let me encourage you to purchase his book using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com.
Dear Dr. Dave, dear Shrinkwrap Radio listeners, hello from Istanbul, Turkey. My name is Yücel Ersöz, an avid listener of Shrinkwrap Radio. Now, I'll continue to speak with my foreign accent. It's more difficult to understand. And that's a good thing. You'll have to pay more attention, and at the very end, I'll be talking about important stuff. I'm not a psychotherapist, I'm not a psychologist, not even a faculty member at a psychology department in a university. In fact, I've only taken a single course in psychology in my entire life, which was Psychology 102. And don't ask me what happened to Psychology 101. After I graduated, I picked up my first psychology book, after I was 40, which was only a few years ago. For 20 years, I've done nothing that has to do with psychology. So, why am I listening to Shrinkwrap Radio? Because Dr. Dave and his guests are helping me answer a very important question. How do I become the self that I truly am? To appreciate all the efforts that Dr. Dave puts in, I thought the least I could do was become a sponsor. And that's exactly what I did. Now, here's the important stuff that I said I would be talking about. Folks, please pick up your laptops, crunch in the numbers, and be a sponsor so we can continue to share the wisdom around the world. It will only take a minute, cost you less than your average dinner, and buy you more soul food than you can ever imagine. Thank you all. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Yücel, in faraway Istanbul, Turkey. How wonderful to have a listener there and one willing to help support this work financially. I hope other listeners will be inspired by your fine example. Unfortunately, I'm afraid we have had no new donors or transcripts since the last episode. Nevertheless, my hope still runs strong. I experienced a delightful synchronicity a couple of days ago. Some of my colleagues from my past at Sonoma State University were gathered in the banquet room at the Hilltop Restaurant in Novato, which is about 30 miles from where I live. My wife was with me and about 10 of my past colleagues. We had been going around the table bringing the group up to date on our lives and recent activities. I spent a fair amount of time speaking about reaching the Shrinkwrap Radio 500th episode milestone. A half hour or so later, the young woman who was serving as our waitress and hostess came back into the room to refill water glasses, and she happened to notice a flyer that one of my colleagues had passed out about the Gestalt therapist Fritz Perls. She said, "Oh, are you guys therapists?" Then she looked at me with a strange expression of recognition, and she said, "I think I know you. I recognized your voice earlier. Are you Dr. Dave?"
And then she went on to rave about shrink wrap radio and how she's been listening to it for years and how wonderful it is and how she's in training to be a therapist herself. She went on and on about how wonderful the show is and how excited she was to meet me. Well, I was equally excited because I almost never have run into a listener anywhere near my own environs, and her enthusiastic endorsement of the show and how much it meant to her almost made it look like she was my plant, given that only minutes before I'd been talking about shrink wrap radio and the reach of it around the world and the gratitude of my listeners. The young lady's name is Alexis. I asked her for a hug, and one of my colleagues took our photo, which I now have posted on shrinkwrapradio.com underneath the In the Media tab. I'm not sure that it makes sense putting it there, but it's the only place that seemed to make any sense. So I hope you'll check it out. Let me remind you that you can use the Amazon.com search widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase more than just books. It's not for nothing that Amazon's been called the everything store. If you'll remember to go to our site and use that widget for all of your Amazon purchases, it will really help us. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. I know we do in my family. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code and shrink wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. And this is just another way you can help to support the show. And in the left-hand sidebar, you can click on special deals from Amazon. For example, you can save up to 90% on textbooks, and there's a little box that has a different special from Amazon that changes every day.
Hi, this is Australian psychologist and author Dr. James Alexander, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. James Alexander, my Aussie soul brother, who is a longtime listener, supporter, and past guest on episode number 341, The Hidden Psychology of Pain, and episode number 397, James Alexander, PhD, interviews David Van Nuys, PhD. We have no recent emails from our listener community, but we do have a lovely piece of audio from listener and past guest Dr. Michael O'Canna, celebrating our 500th episode. Take a listen.
Hey, Dr. Dave. Happy 500 episodes. This is Dr. Michael O'Canna. I just wanted to drop you a line to thank you on this occasion for this fantastic podcast. It's been a while since I've dropped you a line. So your podcast continues to be an incredible source of education for me, as well as soul nourishment. I don't think I've missed an episode in the last 3 years, and that's because whenever I've doubted the relevance of an episode and I've listened, that's tended to be the times that I've been most rewarded by what you've had to share. So Dr. Dave, on this 500 episode anniversary, I want to let you know that I appreciate all the great work you're continuing to do, and I want to encourage you to hang in there. And I'd like to support you so that you can continue to spread all the good work with everyone out there. So thanks again.
Michael, thanks so much for that and for your steadfast support and encouragement. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink at shrinkwrap radio. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Professor Peter Kinderman, both for his activism and for bringing us up to speed on the critique of the disease model of mental illness. My next guest will be psychotherapist and former Buddhist monk Donald Altman. We'll be discussing his new book, Clearing Emotional Clutter, Mindfulness Practices for Letting Go of What's Blocking Your Fulfillment and Transformation. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.